Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Stephanie Ballard, and I represent Mary Jones individually and as executrix of the estate of Samuel Jones in this appeal. My co-counsel is Martin Siegel. If it please the court, I will be addressing the issues of the appropriate legal standards of care and proximate cause as set forth in argument one of our brief, and then I'll turn the argument over to Mr. Siegel, who is trial counsel below, who will more specifically address the facts and the record as discussed in our arguments two and three, demonstrating that summary judgment is inappropriate on any standard in this case. Does the court require a brief recitation of the facts?
I do not. Apparently not.
Thank you. The issue before the court today is whether the trial court erred by granting summary judgment for defendants based upon what it termed a standard of proximate cause, but what was actually in reality the creation of a new standard of care for a subset of police chases such as this one, wherein the pursued vehicle rather than the police vehicle caused the actual injury and collided with the plaintiff. Contrary to what the court says below, this is not actually a legal issue of first impression. The court was presented with facts of first instance because there is no reported case with the same facts wherein the harm was directly caused by the pursued vehicle rather than the police vehicle, but the legal questions surrounding liability and proximate cause in this case do not present matters of first impression, but are governed by well-settled Delaware statutes and case law on municipal liability and proximate cause. The two statutes that are critical here are Title 10 Delaware Code, Chapter 40, the County and Municipal Tort Claims Act, specifically Section 4012, which provides for a waiver of immunity for municipalities arising from negligent acts or omissions involving motor vehicles. More specifically applicable to these facts and enacted after the Tort Claims Act is 21 Delaware Code, Section 4106, which is referred to in the briefs as the Authorized Emergency Vehicle Statute. That sets up two distinct standards for liability for injury caused by an emergency response, and it's undisputed here that it's a police vehicle, this is an emergency response. The city, I believe, conceded below that the emergency vehicle statute does apply.
But are there any cases that address the situation where the police vehicle is not involved in the accident?
Not in Delaware, Your Honor. So, yes, as I said, there were facts of first instance in this case, but we believe the analysis should be the same as in any other tort case where you have the original defendant, the injured plaintiff, and a third party intervening, potentially superseding cause. That is what the suspect's vehicle is here. Again, under Section 4106, the standards of liability set up by the legislature are that the officer is responsible for his non-privileged conduct if it constitutes gross negligence or is willful or wanton. The municipality, on the other hand, or the owner of the vehicle, it's the municipality in this case, is responsible for the non-privileged conduct if it simply rises to the level of ordinary negligence or a wrongful act or omission. This court construed these two statutory provisions in City of Wilmington versus Sikander, again emphasizing that it's enough to get to a jury for the city, for the municipality, on a mere negligence standard. It held in that case the city was not entitled to summary judgment on the plaintiff's claims that the officer's unprivileged ordinary negligence caused their injuries. And we have alleged both gross negligence and civil negligence in this case.
Perhaps I've reconsidered my your earlier question about the facts. In terms of the most proximate cause, I realize that there can be more than one proximate cause. The most proximate cause would be the decision of the fugitive driver to run the red light at a high rate of speed, which caused the collision and the death. Is that correct?
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Now, would you describe that, or is it fair to describe that conduct in doing that as extraordinary negligence or recklessness on the part of that driver?
Yes, I would say the suspect's entire, once they reached a high speed, at any rate, their entire conduct would be reckless, yes.
Well, and the reason I use the words extraordinarily negligent is because of this court's decision in Sims and the holding that as a matter of law, a proximate cause summary judgment can be granted when no reasonable difference of opinion as to the conclusion to be reached on the question of whether an intervening cause is abnormal, unforeseeable, or extraordinarily negligent. So does that phrase and those words, extraordinarily negligent, if applicable, preclude this case from going to the jury?
No, Your Honor. I would distinguish Sims. It's very distinguishable on its facts. That's the case in which the plaintiff was rear-ended by somebody. It unlatched the top of her convertible. She drove around for 3 days without seeking repair. Apparently something happened on the road causing the convertible top to come off and seriously injure her. That was something that to the person who backed up against her 3 days ago was absolutely unforeseeable. The extraordinary negligence also goes to the foreseeability to the original tortfeasor. If what happened later could not have been foreseen and is extraordinarily negligent, the original tortfeasor, the chain of causation is cut. If it's foreseeable based on the original tort, as we argue it is here, the chain of causation continues.
Now, is there any dispute that the persons in the vehicle, in the fugitive vehicle, believe that the chase had ended?
There is some, I believe, ambiguous testimony in the criminal trial record wherein the passenger was describing the conduct of the driver. I don't believe on that it's clear that either or both knew or believed that the chase had ended. I'd also submit that would be a consideration. If the testimony was clear, it would be a consideration for the jury if they thought it ended at that point to do a superseding cause analysis on the facts. It's not something that could be decided by the trial judge. Because if at that point they really had thought the chase had ended and they did something extraordinarily negligent, that could be a superseding cause, but that would be a jury question.
Ms. Ballard, in the case where the policeman or who was driving the car was involved in the accident or in an accident, our prior decision in Sikander addresses that fact pattern, correct?
Correct.
And the liability standard in that circumstance is basically the two statutes that have been referred to. This case involves, however, basically the car, the police chasing another car, which is involved in the accident, but not the police car. In that circumstance, the Superior Court applied a completely different test.
That's correct.
It was a common law test.
Yes, Your Honor. Although we would argue it conflicts with some Delaware common law.
All right, but in order to do that, wouldn't the court have had to make some determination that in this particular fact circumstance that the liability standard that was applied in Sikander should not apply and a new standard should be adopted?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. We believe that we disagree with the standard the court set up. But at a minimum, if the court was going to set up such a standard, it would have to square it with Sikander and with the statutes.
And the court didn't do that, correct? The court did not perform that analysis and distinguish Sikander or discuss or address why a standard other than what's already in the statute should apply.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
So we really have nothing to review as far as the court's reasoning on this issue.
Correct, Your Honor. And the court did something else. They did what I call essentially decide proximate cause in a vacuum. The court made no finding as to negligence. I mean, impliedly, I guess you could assume arguendo, they said even if negligence, then the standard approximate cause supersedes.
Yeah, that's another problem, whether or not there's confusion in terminology or concept.
Yes, and also the fact that we believe that proximate cause can't be decided until after negligence and breach are determined. But it actually, in the last question of the corollary at the oral argument below, the court asked the city, can I just decide proximate cause without deciding negligence? The city answered yes. The court appeared to do that, and we take the position that that was legally an error.
Well, how would you characterize the difference between the standard the Superior Court used of extreme or outrageous and the standard you say is applicable of willful or wanton?
Your Honor, you mean the standard under the under Section 4106?
Mm-hmm. That's the standard under 4106.
It is, Your
gross
Honor.
Negligence or willful or wanton. My question for you is, why aren't willful and wanton, as a phrase, really a synonym for extreme or outrageous? Is there a qualitative difference?
I think logically they probably are close. I did some research to see if I could find a definition of extreme and outrageous under Delaware law, and I couldn't. However, that is only one way in which a party can be found liable under Section 4106. The officer could be liable for gross negligence, and the city is liable if even simple negligence exists.
All right. Well, from a policy point of view, I'm sure you're going to get to this. How do we deal with the fact that police need to apprehend criminals?
That, I would argue, Your Honor, that has been considered by the legislature in how they set up Section 4106. It specifically addresses both emergency vehicles, fire engines, ambulances, and police vehicles, including, I believe it says, when a police vehicle is pursuing an actual or suspected violator of the law. And under those circumstances, the legislature, who establishes the policy by this statute, saw fit to waive immunity to the limited extent set forth in 4106. And I do believe that the only way to justify or understand the court's decision below is that it is a policy decision. It's a decision that police should not be held liable for harm of third parties, but whatever we think of that policy, particularly since the legislature has already spoken, we would argue can't be done judicially. Such a policy, if it exists in the state, would have to come from the legislature.
But when we're talking about negligence, normally we talk about someone in the same or similar circumstances, and gross negligence would just ratchet that up one more level. So in applying this to police officers, do we start with the predicate assumption that they're police officers involved in a chase, which is something that they're supposed to be doing, and realizing that you have to do certain things, including speeding, to apprehend criminals? Is that what we're looking at, gross negligence in the context of a policeman?
Well, the police officer speeding himself per se is a privileged act under the statute,
right.
So he wouldn't be, it's more the his.
Well, that's the way I say that. If you start with the assumption you're allowed to speed, and that might be gross negligence for an ordinary person, we're really talking about an ordinary policeman's standard being involved in a high-speed chase.
Well, you are allowed to speed, Your Honor. That's privileged so long as the driver does not endanger life or property. We'd argue if it got to that point, it could become unprivileged. Also, the Wilmington Police Department has a pursuit policy which has similar cautions. And also, it includes a factor that the court didn't discuss in its opinion that talks about prior conduct by the party you're seeking to apprehend. If you have reason to believe they'll be extraordinarily dangerous, additional caution is warranted. Again, we would say that's something a jury has to consider. The court actually decided that Officer Crawford had complied with the police department policy, but given a 25-factor test, I just don't think that decision could be made by the trial judge at the summary judgment stage.
So we have two standards of care, for want of a better way to characterize it, the statute and the Wilmington Police Pursuit Policy. And you're saying that applying the standards in combination creates factual disputes that a jury needs to resolve?
Yes, Your Honor, along with other facts on the record, inconsistencies in the testimony that my co-counsel will discuss further.
What are the limits on foreseeability, if any, when you're dealing with a fleeing criminal? I mean, is it going to be foreseeable that they're going to start firing shots out of the car? Is it foreseeable that they're going to drive up on the sidewalk? Is it foreseeable that they're going to, the list can go on and on.
Your Honor, it can, and that's why this court has said that in all but the rarest case, it's a jury question. It's totally fact-dependent on the facts of each specific case. I imagine there could be a scenario that was so crystal clear on the facts that a court could decide it at summary judgment, but we submit with the record we have here that this is not that case. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Martin Siegel, counsel for Mary Jones, the executrix of the estate of Samuel Jones. And I would like to address some of the factual issues involved in this case as they apply to the law that is undisputed in this case. Specifically, regardless of the liability and proximate cause standard that this court finds will ultimately apply to this case, the critical analysis is how that standard will be applied to the facts. In determining the question presented by this appeal, certain guiding principles are really beyond dispute. All facts and reasonable inferences from those facts must be looked at in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, in this case the plaintiff. Issues of negligence and proximate cause are, except in the rarest of circumstances, questions of fact which ordinarily must be resolved only by the jury. In order for an event to qualify as a superseding cause, a new and independent act, itself a proximate cause of the injury, which breaks the causal connection between the original tortious conduct and the injury, must occur. And if the intervening act was not reasonably foreseeable, it may be found to be superseding. However, the question of intervening cause should be a question of law only when there can be no difference of opinion as to whether it was abnormal, unforeseeable, or extraordinary. In this case, I think of greatest importance, and co-counsel touched upon this, is that the finder of fact should not look at any one fact in a vacuum. The finder of fact needs to look at the facts as a whole in making the determination of what is foreseeable in this case and what, in fact, might have been intervening or superseding. We believe
in terms of what you compare with to determine whether it's abnormal, unforeseeable, or extraordinary, is the comparison to the population in general? Is the comparison to criminals in Wilmington? What do you compare with?
Your Honor, I believe that that's a very fact-sensitive question, and that in comparing or in making that analysis as to what is foreseeable or what is something that would be deemed to be unforeseeable as a matter of law, the facts as a whole, meaning in this case what the officer was faced with at the time that this pursuit was occurring, need to be looked at as a whole. And the facts that we believe are extremely critical in this instance are the following. Number one, that there was knowledge that this vehicle that was being pursued had in fact been involved in a high-speed pursuit earlier in the day.
Now, let's just stop with that one point. Where does that take us? If you're a criminal or a suspect and you successfully elude the police once in a high-speed chase, then they spot the vehicle again, are you suggesting they shouldn't try to catch them a second time?
I would not suggest that, Your Honor. I don't think that would be an appropriate policy, because in those instances it would then encourage further criminal conduct on the part of a suspect or a vehicle that police were seeking to apprehend. Nonetheless, that is one factor that the police officer who may observe this vehicle after an initial pursuit was unsuccessful, it's a factor that has to be taken into account. And it's a factor that has to be taken into account along with the circumstances of where the pursuit is taking place. I dare say that there may be different standards that would apply if this case or if the situation arose within the city of Wilmington as it did in this case, as opposed to if it arose in a rural area where there were farms dotting the countryside and no intersecting roads and no driveways or means of ingress or egress onto the roadway for perhaps miles.
Could I interrupt you for a second? I understand that it's fairly clear if you're in a situation where it's not likely that there are going to be a lot of other drivers or or pedestrians on the road that may be going 100 miles an hour or more than that to chase a suspect would seem like a reasonable thing to do under the circumstances. I'm more interested in how the jury, as you suggest the jury is supposed to do this, how is the jury supposed to evaluate the level of criminality that's involved? The police officer is chasing a car. Let's say instead of being two suspects of a carjacking, which is what I believe they thought they were chasing, it's somebody who has an innocent person in the car at gunpoint, or other circumstances as to the level of possible harm to innocent life that the police are trying to stop versus simply, if you will, trying to capture some suspects. How is a jury supposed to make some sense out of how serious the crime is and how difficult it would be to apprehend these people later if they gave up on the chase and all those other factors that police officers are trained specifically to react to?
I believe it would be fair for the jury to conduct its analysis against the backdrop of the standards in the first instance that the police agency has put into effect itself that govern these situations. And in the city of Wilmington, as the record reflects, there are a multitude of factors that officers are trained to consider. And in this case, we assert that those factors were not appropriately considered. And we believe that when the facts are taken as a whole, the prior chase that put life and property into danger, the fact that when this pursuit initially started, the vehicle that was being pursued struck another vehicle and took off, immediately accelerating at a high rate of speed, the fact that it approached the first intersection, which is a very busy intersection within the city of Wilmington, and the vehicle blew through a red light and four or five lanes of traffic in the middle of the afternoon, again accelerating at a high rate of speed. When we couple those facts with the fact that the chase entailed speeds that approached 120 miles per hour, that the officer had knowledge that in a very brief period of time, less than three quarters of a mile, this road was going to enter into a residential area, and there was no other place for this road to enter into. There was no other intersecting streets before you got to that residential area. When you place all of those facts together, a jury would be justified in finding that perhaps gross negligence did occur, and that the officer's conduct in initiating and in continuing the chase as they did was in fact a proximate cause, not the proximate cause, but a proximate cause of the collision that eventually occurred with Mr. Jones' vehicle. Your Honor, I notice that my time has expired.
It is. I have a question.
Yes.
And I control the time. The question is, remembering a case called Sammons versus Ridgway, where this court held many years ago that internal regulations of the Board of Education that applied to the operation of school buses, if those regulations were violated by a driver, they constituted negligence per se. Would the pursuit policy duly adopted by whatever form of administrative regulatory procedure the city of Wilmington uses, would that mean that their pursuit policy would constitute negligence per se and the jury would be so instructed?
Your Honor, I'm not certain that that would be the case. However, we are asking this court to remand the case to the trial court for disposition by a jury, and certainly that would be an issue that I would want to research and make the subject of a motion in limine prior to trial, because
it seems to me that just brainstorming it, it would take some of the analysis away from the jury if they were instructed that a failure to follow the pursuit policy constituted negligence per se. Then the issue simply becomes combination of all the factors, does it create gross negligence or willful and wanton conduct?
And as I recall this court's recent pronouncements on negligence per se, one of the factors that needs to be considered is whether the regulations at issue are ones that have been put in place for the protection of some person or class of persons, and certainly it would appear that these regulations have in fact been put in effect for that specific reason.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Andrea Wren. I'll be representing the defendants below, appellees. May it please the court. In this case, the trial court viewed the question presented as an issue of first impression. No Delaware precedent exists on the specific issue of what standard should be applied to determine whether a police officer conducting a high-speed pursuit was the proximate cause of an accident between the pursued vehicle and a third party where the police vehicle had no physical involvement in the collision. The Sikander case...
The court may have chosen to look at the issue that way, Ms. Wren, but wasn't it obligated to at least address whether or not in this circumstance that the liability rule, the standard of liability, was or wasn't established by the two statutes that have been cited to us?
Well, in the defendant's summary judgment motion, we did raise several grounds for granting summary judgment, and one of those grounds was that there was no facts from which a jury could reasonably conclude that Officer Crawford's conduct constituted ordinary negligence. We also raised the argument that we were entitled to summary judgment on the basis of the authorized emergency vehicle statute.
Section 4012, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That was in addition to the proximate causation argument. And the Superior Court decided the case solely on the basis of proximate causation. So implicitly, it viewed the elements of negligence and proximate causation as separate elements, and it's implicit in the decision that the Superior Court decided that Sikander...
Well, that's sort of like taking the rabbit out of the hat, isn't it? I mean, if you...
Well, there is Delaware law...
If you call it proximate cause, then you can... that is, if a judge decides to call this proximate cause rather than standard of care, the judge can ignore two Delaware statutes that appear, at least on the surface, to address the issue?
Well, there is Delaware law that says that duty and breach of duty and proximate causation are separate elements of a claim for negligence.
Yes.
And the proof of negligence or some degree of negligence does not ipso facto prove proximate causation.
Well, here's my problem, and perhaps you can clear it up for us. If I were a trial judge and two Delaware statutes had been cited to me that at least arguably fix, that is, dictate the standard of liability as far as this police officer is concerned, wouldn't it be incumbent upon the trial court to determine and give reasons why those statutes don't apply, thereby making it necessary to adopt a different standard, which is what happened in this case?
Your Honor, one reason I think to account for that is the fact that that argument wasn't properly preserved by the plaintiffs below appellants in the trial court. They did not, in their brief on the summary judgment motion, raise their argument that the standard
your side raised it, correct?
Well, what they didn't raise their argument that they raised for the first time on appeal that that the proximate causation standard adopted by the court and advocated by the defendants was somehow inconsistent with Sikander and the standards applied to negligence under the emergency vehicle statute and the immunity statute.
Well, on page A4 of the appellate's appendix, in the complaint itself, there's an allegation that the officer operated an emergency vehicle in a manner that amounted to gross, willful, or wanton negligence in violation of Section 4106. In your side's answer in cross-claim in paragraph 37, you plead Section 4106. In the motion for summary judgment, again, there's an argument that what the officer did here was privileged under Section 4106. You know, isn't that enough to preserve before the superior court these issues and put it squarely before the judge to decide whether or not these statutes have any bearing at all in the situation?
Well, Your Honor, they never specifically raised the argument that Sikander somehow addressed the issue of proximate causation. They never raised that issue in the lower court and explained that. And if you look at
Well, before we get into that, just let me see if I understand what happened. Normally in a tort case, and what we see is a chronological analysis that looks at duty, breach of duty, proximate cause, and injury or damages. As I read what happened at the Superior Court, at the end of the motion for summary judgment argument, the Superior Court judge said, can I just start with proximate cause? How about if I don't even look at duty, I don't look at breach of duty, I'm just going to start with proximate cause? And your position was, sure, you can start with proximate cause. And then that's the opinion the Superior Court wrote. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason for that is proximate causation and duty and breach of duty are separate elements of a cause of action for negligence. The plaintiff has the burden of proving each of those elements by a preponderance of the evidence. So if there's not evidence in the record that would, support a reasonable jury finding on any one of those elements, then there's a reasonable basis for granting summary judgment.
In other words, the Superior Court said, I'll assume, arguendo, there was a duty and a breach, but this case isn't going anywhere because there's a total absence of proximate cause.
Exactly, because the plaintiff can't meet the burden of proving proximate causation by a preponderance of the evidence based on the facts.
But the difficulty for us is it leaves us without a standard, and I guess your argument is, well, that doesn't really matter. You can deal with the standard in another case where you start with the duty, because here where you just don't have any proximate cause.
I think the duty element has already, I would agree that the standard of care has already been decided, and that's addressed under the emergency vehicle statute and the Tort Claims Act as interpreted in the Sikander case.
Neither of which the trial judge addresses in his opinion, correct?
But there's a separate analysis, and there are separate jury instructions in the trial court that relate specifically to the element of proximate causation.
So we could assume for purposes of this argument that there would be both a duty and a breach of that duty, but it doesn't matter because of proximate cause?
Yes, because there's not sufficient evidence in the record for the plaintiffs to meet their burden of proving proximate causation by a preponderance of the evidence.
The argument that you're confronted with here, though, is that even though breach of duty and proximate cause may be watertight separate compartments, that in this case what the trial judge did was to import essentially what was a new duty or standard of care as the rationale for determining there was no proximate cause.
Well, I don't think he did that any more than if you look at the jury instructions relating to proximate causation. They use the words it's actually the jury instruction relating to superseding causation. That uses the term extraordinary negligence under Civil Jury Instruction 21.3. An intervening act of negligence will constitute a superseding cause, which will relieve the original actor of liability if the intervening act was extraordinarily negligent. Now, just because that jury instruction uses the term extraordinarily negligent, that doesn't impose a standard of care that's different from ordinary negligence. It's the same situation here. The extreme and outrageous conduct standard, I believe, is just an adaptation of the normal rules for determining superseding causation to this unique context.
Well, how can that be? Because the outrageous conduct focuses on the police officer, and the superseding cause focuses on the fugitive.
Well, it's because when you're conducting a high-speed, when a police officer is conducting a high-speed pursuit, in a general sense, it's foreseeable that harm might occur to an innocent third party. So if we were going to use foreseeability as a sole determination of whether the police officer could be the proximate cause of the accident, then proximate causation would be presumed in every case involving a high-speed police pursuit where an accident resulted.
I thought you relied on Sims in this case, that this was such extraordinary negligence that it was a superseding cause.
Yes. The Sims case, we did rely on that, and that's also supported by jury instruction 21.3, because if the intervening act under that jury instruction under the law, if the intervening act was extraordinarily negligent, that's all that needs to be shown for the intervening act to constitute a superseding cause, which cuts off the initial actor's liability. So in this case, there's no question that under the facts, the criminal suspect's conduct, there can only be one reasonable conclusion that their conduct constituted extraordinary negligence. They went through several red lights. They were traveling at a speed of 120 miles per hour under the testimony in the record. They had been involved in a prior collision and were driving, weaving in and out of traffic. So a jury could only reach one reasonable conclusion that their conduct was extraordinarily negligent. And I think what the extreme or outrageous conduct standard does, it's a recognition that in this context, since the danger to third parties is inherent in a high-speed police pursuit, that standard recognizes that the police officer has to do something exceeding ordinary negligence in order to make the harm to third parties, the potential harm to third parties, more likely than it would be in an ordinary high-speed pursuit.
Let me just make sure I understand your position. Is it the defendant's position that the standard of care is distinguished from the standard for proximate cause is set forth in the two statutes that we've been discussing.
Yes, I believe there's a separate causation requirement, and if you look at the language of 21 Delaware Code Section 4106D and also Section 10 Delaware Code Section 4012, both of those statutes use language of causation in addition to the language specifying the standard of conduct, and that would indicate that they are separate requirements. Section 4012.
Bottom line, short answer is that your client's position is that Section 4106 and Section 4012 set forth the standard of the duty of care, the standard of liability.
Yes, and they use the word.
Which means that if we are to affirm, we would have to find that the standard that was adopted by the Superior Court relates solely to proximate cause.
Yes, Your Honor. And we also raised the argument in our answering brief that even if you look at the general Delaware law regarding proximate causation, that doesn't apply to this specific context of a high-speed police pursuit. Even under that analysis, under the jury instructions regarding proximate causation and superseding causation, the plaintiffs still can't meet their burden of proving proximate causation by a preponderance of the evidence. So even if the lower court hadn't adopted the extreme or outrageous conduct standard, the result reached by the court would be correct based on general Delaware law regarding proximate causation, because the plaintiffs, they can't establish but-for causation, and it's also clear in this case, based on the undisputed facts in the record, there's no question that the criminal suspect's conduct constituted extraordinary negligence, and the police officers didn't do anything to cause that extraordinary negligence. The only evidence in the record that we have Matthews' testimony saying that he didn't think the police proceeded with the pursuit after the low-speed collision with a red vehicle where the suspects were making a left turn onto A Street. They clipped the red vehicle at a very low speed. And Matthews testified that after that, he didn't even think that the police proceeded with the pursuit because he didn't hear any sirens at that point. And we have no that testimony is uncontroverted. We have no testimony from any other witness saying otherwise, saying that the suspects believed that the pursuit was still ongoing at the time of the collision. And it would require the jury to speculate for it to conclude that the suspects believed that the pursuit was ongoing at the time of the collision involving the decedent.
Is there any deposition or testimony of the actual driver?
No, there is not. The actual driver was he was tried, I believe, in a criminal trial, and he chose to assert his Fifth Amendment rights not to testify. And that trial, it's my understanding that ended in a mistrial, and the state decided not to retry the case because they didn't believe they had sufficient evidence to prove which of the suspects was driving the vehicle. So he did not testify in the criminal case. We only have Curtis Matthews' testimony at that trial. And Curtis Matthews has since passed away, so he was not deposed in the civil case, in this case. And Lamar Comer, who we believe was probably the driver of the pursued vehicle, he, to my knowledge, was not subjected to a retrial of the criminal charges, and the plaintiffs, for whatever reason, chose not to depose him in this case. So we have no testimony from anyone else. There were no other witnesses other than Officer Crawford and his partner, Officer Rents. So the only testimony we have is Matthew's testimony at Lamar Comer's criminal trial, where he said that he didn't think the police officer continued with the pursuit after that first accident. So there's nothing showing that even if Officer Crawford was exceeding the speed limit, the criminal suspects weren't aware of that. So nothing Officer Crawford did caused the criminal suspects to engage in extraordinarily negligent conduct. And I believe that would be something that would have to be proven in order to impose, in order to prove proximate causation in this case.
I still need some help in being assured that the trial judge didn't conflate proximate cause and a negligence standard. As I read his opinion, it sounds like he was somehow impressed or guided by an assumption that a majority of states have adopted an extreme or outrageous standard. But if you look at the states cited, the opinions all talk about the negligence standard. They don't talk about some extreme or outrageous bar that has to be crossed in order to meet the burden of proving proximate cause. And in fact, only three states talk about extreme or outrageous as the standard. Help me understand what he was getting at by creating a whole cloth with no help from any Delaware case or any Delaware statute, a concept of extreme or outrageous before one crosses the bar of proximate cause. From where does that come?
Well, the court also relied on some secondary sources which do state that that is the majority position.
You mean the CJS citations and the ALR citations?
Yes, Your Honor. It relied on, as you said, the three cases, and those cases conduct a review of other authorities and other jurisdictions, and they infer from those cases, after analyzing those cases, that this is the majority position. They infer that the standard to be applied to proximate causation is an extreme or outrageous conduct standard. And I would agree that it is unclear in some of the cases the way they're drafted, that, you know, they do talk about negligence, but then they decide the issue based on proximate causation. And I think that's the source of the confusion. And I think in a number of these cases, the trial court did decide the issue based on negligence, but then for whatever reason, the appellate court said, well, the result's correct, but it should have been decided on the ground of proximate causation and not negligence.
In a normal case, wouldn't we look first at the officer's duty? And if we decide the standard is this extreme or outrageous standard, and we concluded that the officer's conduct exceeded that standard, it was extreme or outrageous, and then we have a breach of duty, and then if there was an injury proximately caused by that, we would then look to see whether there was an intervening cause that broke up the chain, wouldn't we? The difficulty we're having is this, and the trial judge sometimes talks about it as a standard, but he doesn't always relate it to proximate cause. So that's our real question. Is it clear from the opinion that what the court was saying was only proximate cause, or was the court really saying, I don't think you violated the standard of being extreme and outrageous?
I do think there is language in the court's decision where the court stated that it was confining the issue to proximate causation.
I know they said that in part of the opinion.
And the court said, pointed out that the plaintiffs didn't raise any contrary standard applicable to proximate causation to guide the reasoning of the lower court.
Well, the conclusion is Officer Crawford's conduct was not extreme or outrageous as a matter of law. So one way to read that is to say he had a duty not to conduct himself in an extreme or outrageous manner. Are you looking for what I just read?
Actually, I was looking for another portion of the opinion.
Yeah, I will withdraw my question. I'm fine. Go ahead with your argument.
Actually, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Siegel, you have the rebuttal. According to my clock, you have 1 minute and 37 seconds. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few quick points. Going back to Justice Jacobs, some of his questions. Essentially, the problem here is that the proximate cause standard, if that's what it is, eviscerates or vetoes the Section 4106 standard. So, therefore, if he's calling it approximate, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I think that I misread the clock and that everyone's out of time. I apologize to you. I brought you up here to no avail, just to embarrass myself and my poor clock watch.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for an interesting argument. We'll take the case under advisement.